Welcome, everybody. This is Diana Oblinger, President of EDUCAUSE, and you're participating in the EDUCAUSE Analytics Sprint. First of all, I want to thank our sponsors because the sprint's been made possible by a grant from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and is being sponsored by IBM, and they are one of our EDUCAUSE Silver Partners. So let me thank them for their generous support for today and the next 2 days. Now, you may not have been in a sprint before, but this is the first day of 3 days of intensive activity around analytics, and we're calling it a sprint. In addition to the webinar, we are going to have guest bloggers, Twitter, IdeaScale, community polls, and lots of things that are going to add depth to the discussions. So I hope you won't just participate in this webinar, but you'll take advantage of all the different things that the sprint has to offer. And go to that sprint website and find your way to lots of different valuable resources, our animation. I think you'll find a wealth of information there. Now, just a word about the webinar, because we've designed this to be very interactive, and you've seen lots of chat going on, and there are lots of people who are going to join us. On the left-hand side of your screen, we've got a large chat box, and what we'd like for you to do there is to share your comments, insights, resources, URLs, a variety of information. If you've got questions that you would like for us to pose to the speaker, you'll notice that there's a chat space below the slides that says submit a question for the speaker. So if you've got a question, put it there and we will be pulling those as we go through the presentation and bringing those to the speakers at various points in the webinar. Now, just to the right of that, you'll see that there is a roster, and you can send private messages to people as you hover over their individual name, and you can select private chat and talk to them directly. But an important name is at the top of that list, and it's technical help. If you have any technical questions or problems, if you just send a private message to technical help, we will have someone get right back to you. And for those of you who want to use the back channel, please tweet using the tag EDUSPRINT, EDUSPRINT. And I know this is a common question, but we will have the session, the slides, and the entire archive available later on today on the Sprint website. So if you want to go back and replay it, you'll have the opportunity later on today. Now, just a word about analytics before we begin. Analytics, as you probably all know because you're here, is of increasing interest to higher education, and it's being driven by lots of different things like accountability, affordability, efficiency, and continuous improvement. And our institutions are using analytics to inform decisions about areas like admissions, fundraising, learning, student retention, and operational efficiency. So it's obviously a really big deal. But sometimes we don't quite know what we're talking about with analytics. So at EDUCAUSE, we use a working definition of analytics as the use of data, statistical analysis, and explanatory and predictive models that allow us to gain insights and act on complex issues. So analytics is a whole lot more than reporting. You can use it to spot trends, make choices, and it can involve regression analysis, forecast, simulation, prediction, visualization, optimization, lots of different things. But obviously, Sprint has a lot to offer higher education. Now, just a bit about how the sprint is structured. We're going to start at the top today. We're going to begin with President Freeman Hrabowski and two of his team from the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, to take a broad view of analytics. And although most of our audience may be from IT, we really did intentionally start with the president. Because when we talk to people about analytics, leadership and cultural change are always cited as the most important and the hardest parts of analytics. And obviously, the president plays a really big role in leadership and culture change. And of course, analytics isn't just about what goes on inside the institution. Legislators, governing boards, accrediting agencies, and the public are interested as well. And with some of those major impacts, such as performance-based funding, it's pretty obvious that presidents have a strong perspective on analytics. Tomorrow, we will shift the focus a little bit and talk about how analytics can inform learning. Marsha Lovett's going to talk about the faculty experience of analytics, and Ellen Wagner will share some lessons learned from a project that has analyzed literally hundreds of thousands of learner records. And then on day three, we're going to focus on something pretty fundamental, whether you're looking at teaching and learning or enterprise, and that's the data. The data that goes in as well as the data that comes out as dashboards, predictions, and optimizations. So on day three, we're going to focus on the system, if you will. And Sarah Gomez and her team from the University of Washington are going to talk about data and present their approach to managing enterprise data. And Gordon Wishon and John Rome from Arizona State University are going to talk about the other end, the output, about putting data into the hands of stakeholders. So lots that we are going to cover in 3 days, and we hope you will find it of value. And what I'd like to do without further ado is to introduce you to our first set of speakers, because as I said, we're going to start at the top, and we're going to start with someone who knows a lot about analytics and has catalyzed massive positive changes in higher education. And today we're joined by President Freeman Hrabowski III. Dr. Hrabowski has served as president of University of Maryland Baltimore County since 1992, and there's a link there. You can read more about his background. He's got a master's in mathematics, a PhD in higher education administration and statistics. He's done all kinds of research publications. I first got to know him on some pretty exciting NSF panels, and he has been absolutely outstanding as a national and international leader, particularly in areas such as minority participation in STEM education. He's on lots of national boards. He's won a lot of awards, and he's led his institution, the University of Maryland Baltimore County, to being recognized as the number one up-and-coming university, not once, but 3 years in a row. And in 2011, there were added accolades for being the best undergraduate teaching institution. So we will welcome Freeman to the session today. He's going to be joined by Jack Seuss, who is UMBC's Vice President for Information Technology and Chief Information Officer. Now, many of you may know Jack because he's a very strong participant in EDUCAUSE and NSF, as well as Internet 2, and he's led projects, as many of you know, across the board, networks, ERP, identity management, cyber infrastructure, and the like, so very much experienced in information technology. And also joining them today is Michael Dillon, who is the Director of Institutional Research at UMBC. And, of course, analytics isn't just about IT, it's also about institutional research, and Michael's work has included evaluating institutional initiatives and studies where he's looked at models that attribute different variables with student success. He's been a champion for institutional research offices to work closely with IT. So we appreciate you doing that, Michael, because we know that IT and IR need to work together on this. So let me just say a final word, and that is that you all may know that the University of Maryland, Baltimore County has actually a very long track record of leadership in analytics, and you're going to hear more about that today. So we'll jump right in. And Freeman, let me start out by posing a question to you. And you wrote a great article a while back about assessment and analytics and institutional transformation. And you said that supported by information technology, assessment and analytics can change institutional culture and drive the transformation in student retention, graduation, and success. Can you say a little bit more about that? Because that's kind of the crux of the issue.
Sure. Diana, thanks a lot, and thanks for the introduction. Let me start by saying I think it's important for presidents and provosts particularly to be closely connected to IT professionals, to the chief information officer for me, Jack Seuss, and to others such as Mike Dillon, who's here, also in institutional research, because we need to understand the issues. From my perspective, one of the great challenges we face in higher education is that we often make decisions based on anecdotal information. We have this folklore on every campus where we are the best at that, or we are the only ones to do that, without having really looked at the data carefully to understand it. And so from our perspective, as we've looked at our strengths and our weaknesses, it's very important, we have found over the years, to analyze that data, to bring to the table all of the statistical methodologies we can use, but also the use of computing in such a way that we can look, as you said, at the trends and the patterns as we're looking at different populations. And so the most important aspect of all of this for me is the big question: do you know your students? Do you know the challenges they're facing? Do you understand the research capabilities? And have you looked at ways of analyzing the data so that you can make the most intelligent decisions? And for us, analytics has meant, as we've asked questions, we've been able to move to the next level. That means asking good questions, being honest about our strengths and weaknesses, and then keeping an open mind to try different approaches, innovative approaches to solving problems. I can keep talking, or you can ask me more about it.
I was going to ask you to say a little bit more about analytics and how you use it and the kind of role that it plays.
Sure.
For UMBC.
Sure. I mean, from our perspective, we have been able to look with great specificity at different areas of concern and think about a combination of leadership, having the most important people in an institution involved in the process, a way of looking at institutional culture. I often talk about a book by David Brooks, The Social Animal. He talks about culture as everything to do with our habits, our beliefs, our practices, our relationships, and even the kinds of tensions that we have among people. In higher education, we tend to think about each person having a role to play. If we're going to change the culture of an institution, we have to get people ready to keep an open mind and to look at the data differently and to understand how we can analyze it. And the most important challenge, quite frankly, is that often people are resistant to change. We have found that using analytics to demonstrate what works and what doesn't work, to understand more deeply the different problems, we get people to think carefully about how else we might do the work, how else we might change the way we're thinking, and quite frankly, sometimes even about our assumptions, to question the assumptions that we are making based on what the analysis of data will tell us. And so analytics can help you change the culture in very interesting ways, and it takes leaders asking good questions and keeping an open mind to have that happen.
You know, one of the groups that sometimes asks tough questions are trustees. And we've heard situations where trustees have sort of driven the move to analytics, sometimes welcome perhaps, sometimes not. How have you had the trustees or the regents there at UMBC involved?
Right. Well, our regents are the regents for the University System of Maryland, and we're very fortunate to have Britt Curran, who is I call him my partner, and I mean he is very clearly the academic leader of the entire system, and he works with the regents to understand the challenges. And so we have metrics that we're using and a dashboard, and it works really well, whether talking about how low-income students are doing, how students from underrepresented groups are doing in the STEM areas, what we're doing in economic development, what graduation and retention rates look like. The regents are very involved in working with the chancellor to evaluate presidents on their ability to handle those matters and to explain what goes well and what does not. I will tell you what's most fascinating for me about the dashboard indicators is that it gives all of us a chance to look at how we compare with our peers and with others in the system. And it gives us a chance to think very carefully about ways of helping more students succeed. One of the most important initiatives for our campus and for the system right now has been course redesign. And in that process, which the regents have been involved in, which Britt has been talking about around the nation, which I'm talking with about around the nation, we have been changing the way we are teaching and learning from chemistry to psychology. And to give you another example that you wouldn't think about, some of our students of Asian descent, it turns out in certain groups, have not done as well in their writing courses because of some problems with English. We've been able to look at that data and have actually redesigned the writing course in such a way to give more individual attention to those students, to talk about more interaction among them, more opportunities for writing. And that one analysis of those writing scores has made a big difference in redesigning that course. Well, the regents are well aware of all of those redesign efforts for all of our institutions, including UMBC.
So could you tell us just a little bit more or maybe a few more specifics on what you've done, not just with the use of analytics, but the kinds of course changes you've actually made as a result of that?
But if you look at the, first of all, because I want Jack to talk about some of this also, but the chemistry redesign has been fascinating. I've been showing, I have on my iPhone an example from a video that shows it, and it makes the point immediately that you'll see, rather than having the course being specifically only as lecture and discussion, I mean, we accept the fact that students are often bored in courses that are not interactive. We believe that the hybrid approach is going to be more important in a lot of courses with online work, but also with group work. And so in our Chemistry Discovery Center, we have students working in groups of four. We randomly assign them. They are each group is working on problems that require them to develop theories. Instead of giving them the traditional theories in the first year of chemistry, they have to really struggle and discuss and solve problems that will lead them to discover the theories themselves. What it does is, it's frustrating for students in many ways, but what we found is that there has been a substantial increase in numbers of students able to pass the course and then actually get a B or better. We now have an 84% pass rate, so it's up literally about 50%. So we can show through analysis over a number of years of grades and through our demonstrating that the rigor in this approach is actually greater than it was with the traditional course, that the redesigned course in the Chemistry Discovery Center for the first year is far more effective in helping students to succeed and keeping more students in the major and moving on to the next year of chemistry.
Did you want Jack to add any more to that? Because it's a great example.
Sure.
I think another example where data has really made a big difference, Diane, has been over the last 5 years, my colleague John Fritz, who many may know from teaching and learning space, has done a lot of work with pulling data out of our learning management system. And one of the key things that really came out of that is we began by looking at that to discover what faculty were using the learning management system in interesting ways. All of a sudden, we would see that certain faculty in a discipline would have courses where students were using the course almost every day, high amounts. We could tell by the number of hits that were generated that certain courses would be off of the charts compared to others. And what that allowed us to do is to make connections to faculty to begin finding how they were using the tools and really sort of putting them in a spot where they can be talking to their colleagues about effective use of these tools. It's just so much more effective to have faculty talking to other faculty about ways that they're using technology effectively. This really became a great spotlight. We've subsequently modified that to now give students some indication of how they're using the tool compared to other students in a class. And these are the kinds of things that we think are just at the infancy of how you begin to use data in interesting ways of showing students how they do things. Michael, I don't know, you might want to mention some of the studies that you've done just in looking at like mathematics and other courses in terms of student success.
Sure. Well, one of the things that common wisdom or anecdotal evidence suggested that students who come to UMBC transferring from two years community colleges struggle in particular science courses, particularly math courses, and we were able to gathering data from many different sources, National Student Clearinghouse, our internal files coming from Maryland, et cetera, we're able to take a look at the grade distribution by the origin of the student. And what we found is the same courses that transfer students are struggling with are exactly the same courses that freshmen are struggling with. So the strategy that we developed was one based on not just selecting particular students, but looking generally at what the weaknesses are.
Yeah, Diana, I think you'll appreciate this. When we are in a leadership meeting with President's Council, and you've got Jack there and Mike there and others, and we are presenting data. People are presenting data on performance in courses or retention rates for students who are affiliated with groups versus those who are not affiliated. What happens is people will ask more questions as they see what we've been able to determine about performance. The good news is that often using analytics, people in the room can immediately find the answers rather than having to write something up, send it to institutional research, and wait 2 or 3 weeks before we get it. And so we are able to have an even richer conversation right there and often come to conclusions about next steps as we think about ways of either saving money or of helping students or of analyzing the data. Probably the most interesting stat for me recently is that every time a student has to retake the first semester of chemistry, it costs the university $1,700. And so the fact that we have reduced substantially numbers of students, I mean hundreds of students who are not having to retake courses over several years, means we're not only improving the quality of education and knowing more about the performance of our students, we're actually saving money.
We've got lots of different questions to ask you all about whether this applies to other types of courses, whether it still works in upper division chemistry courses, whether this kind of design change is applicable to traditional face-to-face settings as well as online. So I'll give you a moment to maybe give us a quick response to that, but then I want to ask you another question that's come up in the chat.
So, let me just say that we have focused first on first-year science because we find that if students are able to do well in that first-year course, they tend to do much better in the next level of course, whether you're talking about math, chemistry, physics, any of those quantitative areas. We tend, around the country, as you know, we call first-year science and engineering barrier or weed-out courses. So that's been the focus, but it's worked so well that right now several departments are taking it to the next level. For example, the organic chemistry, people are in the process of redesigning that right now. The other point is that we were a part of the Ithaca study involving hybrid courses in such areas as statistics and have found that the results show that those hybrid courses have been as effective as the traditionally taught courses.
Yeah, I would just add, Diana, that this year we're revamping our freshman composition courses, and we also have an effort that is ongoing in the digital humanities. One of the things that we've started is an innovation fund for pedagogical innovation. As part of that, analytics is a key element. You've got to be doing assessment and providing data to show that what you're doing is going to make a difference or has made a difference. And so I think we're really seeing the culture start to change here at UMBC.
So say a little bit more about the culture change and how you've accomplished some of this, because one of the questions that came in that I think we hear repeatedly is, gosh, this feels a little Big Brother-like, and how do you get people to get over being nervous about somebody having data?
You know, I think the name of the game is trust. What is great about UMBC is that people have been working together long enough to go through good and bad times, and there's a lot of trust here. There really is. I'm very excited that the Chronicle has for several years had us on that list of great places to work. Faculty and staff will say it's a good place to work. And the key to that is this, that we're not making anyone do anything. The approach, and quite frankly, you really can't make people do anything in the university. The best you can do is give them opportunities to look at options and to pilot things to see what works. And so the changing the culture has meant giving faculty who were interested in finding a better way to do things, in helping more students succeed, a chance to try something new, and then using analytics to assess it, to see how it works, and to change even parts of that initiative as necessary. As we've had success on a smaller scale, more people have been willing to get involved. And that's whether talking about helping minorities in science or helping students in general or improving retention rates or increasing the number of women faculty. In each case, it's been a matter of a pilot effort started by a few people who wanted to do it, finding what success means, and then having success breed success.
Well, one of the things that you mentioned a little bit earlier is how much you save when a student doesn't have to retake chemistry, for example. Can you say a little bit more about where you've seen the most value accrue to UMBC through your analytics initiatives? Because I think it's not maybe just financial either.
No, I would say the fact that we see our students succeeding in larger numbers, all races, men and women, not only in science and engineering, but in general, has been the most important point, that we can say to families of future students that we care so much about these students. We can tell you that the probability of a student coming here who's admitted actually succeeding is very, very high, and that's not only because of that student's academic preparation, but also because we really take the time to understand what it takes for that student to succeed, and we connect the student to some group. We've got all kinds of affiliated groups on campus because through analytics, we learned through IT and institutional research and the groups that were working on retention, we really did learn that a student's chances for remaining here and being successful are greatly enhanced if that student is connected to some group. And so we've learned a great deal that has helped us to recruit and retain and graduate students.
Michael?
Anything? Yeah, Michael, go ahead.
Sure. So let me start off by giving you an IR perspective on this. This has been very transformative for us in institutional research here at UMBC. I had a great belief that in order for institutional research to do its job, that it needed to be integrated into the BI analytics solution, that it could not simply do what they had been doing in the past and simply taking information from the information system, then digesting it and basically, you know, pushing it out to state federal reporting, that we would actually be part integrated within the business intelligence. So right now, when institutional research produces a report that goes to the federal government or the state government, it does not first take the information from the data warehouse and then massage it and push it out into state and federal reports. All of that information is directly from the data warehouse itself. So all we're doing is taking and running a report from the warehouse, and that's how we do reporting. This has been very transforming because now anyone who has access to this information system, to the data warehouse, can get exactly the same pieces of information that we send to the state and to the federal government. And because we now are giving out the ability to run reports to many more people, then really what institutional research is doing is less as a report writer than as a manager or a consultant for reporting around campus. And this is true on so many different levels. So when you were talking before about changing culture and the trust of, you know, being able to push all of this information out, this is how this is really being done, is by providing information which is very reliable when it's not, to be able to change it, to do it in real time, and then to train basically people to be able to use their information. And once you get, you know, past that and you have people wanting to do it, then it becomes a steamroller effect.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Sure.
Yeah, Diana, this is Jack. From my perspective, I think one of the real key wins that we've had is from an IT perspective, we've become much more agile in being able to meet information needs of the campus. I want to give credit to a good friend of mine, John Bielek at Drexel. John had done some work in the early 2000s, and Drexel did a presentation talking about how they did all their enterprise reporting out of the data warehouse. And I read that somewhere in 2004 and 5 after having done a PeopleSoft implementation where we didn't do that. And I realized that when we did the student portion of PeopleSoft, that was really the way to go. And so we focused entirely on doing all of our reporting out of the data warehouse from day one on our PeopleSoft implementation. And what that has done is it has empowered the functional offices to be in control of their reporting. My staff are managing the data warehouse, and we will help with some more complex reports if they have questions. But by and large, almost all of the reporting questions that used to have to require a programmer to sit there and write some program are now being handled by the functional users. And this is empowering to them. They feel like they can now support the end users much better than they could. And we're also now seeing that this rolls out into the colleges, the dean's offices, and other places where they can take ownership of doing the reporting that they need.
Can I just add on to that? Another piece of this has to do with data quality. In the old days, what we would do is we would pull out extracts again from the information system, and then we'd have to go clean them up in order to, before we could send them off to the state. Well, now we have set into place a whole series we call data quality checks that are being used not just for IR, but for all types of data quality, and it's being promoted not by institutional research or even administration, but from the offices that need that information to be correct. And they're the ones who are asking us, can you build these data quality checks so that we can improve the quality of our data?
And Diana, this is Jack. One last thing that I'll add is I put up a slide that Michael worked with one of our key stakeholders, Yvette Mosey Ross, who is in charge of enrollment management as associate provost. And we did a retreat last year for our campus leadership. It's about 200 people come, most of the academic chairs, a lot of the senior staff. And one of the poster sessions was really around how to use analytics. And Yvette came up with, I thought, a great poster, and some of the questions that she had were this, what if you knew? And she had these questions there about who your students are, where they come from, how they're doing. This really began to engage the faculty. And then we began by having another slide that was there that talked about how they could be using this to be able to be targeting marketing efforts or looking at where they can increase opportunities for faculty and peer engagement. So what we're trying to do is empower people as low as possible to be able to take advantage of data to do their jobs better. And I think that's a fun thing to be at right now when you can do that.
Absolutely. So, Freeman, a question back to you, because obviously there's technology behind this. We haven't even talked about the skill sets or the personnel involved, but how have you handled freeing up resources to do this? Because I assume you didn't have money fall from the sky that allowed you to do it.
Right.
And did you get any criticism for having made these kinds of investments? We may want to have Jack and Michael weigh in on
sure.
some of the other investments, too.
Sure. You know, it's I go back to Britt Curran and our system. It's great that we are all focused on retention and graduation. The country is. And so here is the point. When we could show through analytics that some of the things we were doing were definitely leading to more students succeeding, the leadership group had been involved in that process all along. We do believe in shared governance. And when I say the leadership group, I don't mean just vice presidents and deans. I'm talking about faculty leaders also very involved and student leaders getting involved to understand what we're doing to help more students succeed. When it became clear that some of the efforts, including the course redesign, for example, the hybrid courses, those things were leading to more students succeeding, everybody said, we don't have a choice. We've got to do these things because we want to make sure that we can say to students, you will succeed when you come here. So we put students first. We focus on the fact that by having more students succeeding, quite frankly, we'd have more money, and we'd have a reputation more and more as a place that cares about students, which would attract more students, which will mean obviously more money. And so we didn't see it as just putting in money and seeing what was going to happen. We saw it as an investment to building the quality of the institution and in building the effectiveness of UMBC in supporting students. So it's worked well, but there was buy-in all along through transparency. Everybody has been involved. The key players, all of them have been very involved in this process of understanding. You know, the point that comes to my mind, Diana, is this, that just as when we talk about auditing and we have to help institutions understand that's not just the function of the administrative affairs area, but it's everybody involved in internal controls and money. When you talk about data analysis and you talk about looking at trends, it's not just IT and OIR. It's those people as experts working with all of us to make all of us, quite frankly, experts in a way that we've not been before. So it's distributing the power to make the kinds of analysis and decisions that we before were left to several people with static reports. It is an interactive process that involves all of us asking questions, going to the data, looking at the analysis, and then based on that, coming to some collective decision about how to spend the money to make sure we're helping students.
So maybe you can say, sorry, I think I probably just cut Jack off. when you finish responding, then I want to ask a question about your organizational structure and data governance. But I think, Jack, you were saying something.
Well, I was just going to add that most of the initial cost of the actual tools has come out of my division of IT. But one of the ways that I look at this and one of the justifications we've made is that by really being able to move reporting out to the broader campus, we have freed up so many staff resources that used to be dedicated to reporting needs that they're now able to be covering other activities that are of higher value. And this really has been a transformative effect, one, in sort of cutting down in a time where we can't add staff very easily, being able to do more with the same level of staff but at a higher level, doing the things that IT staff really can try to do, which is bringing in new applications, integrating those things within our campus environment. So for us, I think this has really been a great example of leveraging the fact that by providing these tools, we've been able to empower the rest of the campus to do work that, frankly, it would be better to get my staff off of doing than what they were in the past. So that's been really one of the key wins for us.
Mm-hmm. Your question about governance, as you might expect, the provost has a group that will focus on matters involving academic and other matters, and then there's the President's Council, which has provosts, all vice presidents, and others. What is key here is that the CIO, Jack Seuss, as vice president of institutional technology, actually reports to me because I need to understand enough to ask the right questions. It's not just about getting answers to questions. It seems to me that a part of enlightened leadership involves understanding what questions should be asked. And to ask good questions, you have to have context. And Jack provides that for me. Similarly, our institutional research head reports to the provost's office and is very involved in work with the President's Council and Provost's Council because we see him as a major resource who is asking questions all the time and, quite frankly, who is giving us information that sometimes we like and sometimes we don't like. It depends on what it is. I have to tell you that for the first time, I saw our institutional research person, who's kind of like an auditor and lawyer all in one, and I saw him with the OIT person telling the President's Council that at our upcoming leadership retreat with about 200 of my best friends on campus that we're going to have something called a data gallery. And I want you to hear about this data gallery because it speaks volumes about transparency and professional development of the entire campus. So I'm going to ask Mike to talk about this data gallery that gets him so excited.
Sure. So this is an opportunity really for us to showcase what we have been able to deliver over the last few years with analytics. So we have a large space that has about 15 computer screens, and in each one of those screens is going to be an interactive report that's going to highlight different aspects, whether it's financial, student success, space initiatives, etc. And then surrounding those 15 interactive dynamic reports are going to be a series of posters that basically show how we got where we got, right? So you can imagine you have a dynamic report looking at student success, which can be drilled down all the way down to the student level if you want to. And then surrounding that gallery would be a series of posters that explain exactly the initiatives that took place that led to the success that we saw.
To put that into perspective for some background, in 2005, early 2006, we released our campus strategic plan, UMBC 2016. For those that don't know, UMBC is a young institution. We turned 50 at 2016. And so at that time, what we did is we laid out our vision of where we hoped UMBC would be at 2016. And some of what this data is going to be showing is, over the last 8 years, how far we've come. And so it allows people to be able to look back and see some of the changes that have occurred, areas where we have made big difference, areas where we still need to make further improvement. And so that's, I think, the exciting part about that piece of this. I should say, and I apologize to the audience, you may have seen some acronyms, RECs. Because we have a dog motif, we're the retrievers, we call our reporting exchange RECs, and so that's where some of the slides come off with the idea of RECs. I also passed over a slide earlier that it'll be a resource that's out there that is a 20-minute discussion that Michael, Yvette, and myself had related to how we have launched governance, how we have done reports. It'll give some demonstrations of some of the kinds of interactive reports that we have if people want to take a look at these sorts of things as well. We probably should, though, talk just a little bit about governance from an IT standpoint, and I'll be brief, and Michael can chime in if I miss something, and that was we had an initial governance structure that looks like a lot of campuses where we had a data management committee. What we realized is we were meeting twice a year, and it was Michael and I talking to the audience, and it really was not actively engaging the group that was there. What we did is we rethought the whole idea of data management, and so Michael came up with this idea of having a set of small subcommittees that meet on a relatively frequent basis. So we have a data warehouse team which meets weekly, and they're looking at all sorts of changes, how the data warehouse can go, where they want to be moving. We have a user group that meets monthly, and what this group does is it's just stakeholders from all the colleges, all the divisions, who come in and they can ask questions, they can share what they're doing. We have experts there to help them.
It's a brown bag.
But it's a brown bag for just sharing lessons learned. We have a data quality team that meets on a regular basis that's chaired by someone in Michael's office. And so one of the things we've done is written lots of reports that allow people to sort of look for odd results coming in. And this way it can identify data that needs to be cleansed and corrected. And so we get people working on that. We have a group that looks at data access and security. This brings in the registrar along with OIT in terms of how we do FERPA. And then we have an internal group that looks at how we set up the data warehouse, how we want to expand it when we want to add new data sources into this. And then lastly, we have a training team. And there's a lot of overlap that cuts across these, but these groups are meeting regularly. And now our data management council meeting is really the summary twice a year of these groups reporting back on all they've done. There's a lot more interaction between the stakeholders who are on the Data Management Council and the groups that are actually doing the work.
Yeah, very, very quickly, two things about this. All of these teams evolved by themselves. They were not really formal. So this is really a very much of an organic model, and that what we did is we just took a look at what was being developed and evolving and then spearheaded that into the Data Management Committee instead of the other way around. And secondly, that in each one of these teams, it is really interdepartmental. There is at least one, and often case more than one person, from institutional research, from IT, and from enrollment management.
Diana, there's one thing that I think is very clear, and that is knocking down boundaries across units, transparency for all, and building strong and healthy relationships among people coming from different areas and getting rid of the notion of turf, focusing more on problem solving and understanding the data in order to make the best decisions.
And I'm glad you raised that, because obviously something has happened here with your IT and IR people where they are not, it would appear to be, concerned about turf. And we've got lots of questions that people have had about how did you bring together IT and IR? What kinds of challenges did you face? Does IR report to the CIO? So maybe you all have some wisdom to share with other institutions about how you got those two offices to work so well together.
Let me just start by saying I do think that one of the most important decisions I made some years ago was to have the CIO reporting to me, having the VP for IT reporting to me, because I needed to make the statement that technology was just that important to the campus, that I needed to be much more involved and not hands-off, and most important, able to set an example of learning from the people in both IT and OIR. The second point is that we've got a superb institutional research person who has a strong academic background and has, just as does our OIT CIO, has the right personality. It seems to me you need leaders who are willing to get beyond ego and focus on ideas and get beyond TURF and focus on problem solving in the entire university. What has helped us is taking the time to think about the big question, what's in the best interest of UMBC? Not of one unit, one area, but what's in the best interest of the entire university. And, but that requires people, that requires leaders who are willing to, I think, open their minds and look at the other person's perspective and challenges as we think about how people can work effectively. And it just takes time to get the right people together. I mean, the best news for us is this is like a dream team. We've got people who know how to work effectively together. If you don't have people who are willing to work with each other and to get beyond TURF, it's hard to get things done.
So one thing I would say, Diane, that's probably helpful is it's interesting. When Michael came to UMBC in 2006, Michael had a vision for data warehousing and data reporting that probably wouldn't have looked at the tools we're now using as the basis for that vision. And, you know, he and I spent a lot of time together. Sometimes we disagreed, but what was really key, I think, was that we spent a lot of time together and we kept talking and we kept engaging one another. We both shared the same vision. You know, we wanted to be able to make data be able to be used effectively on the campus. And what we ultimately had to realize is that we both had a role to play in doing that. And I think that that really has been the key thing is finding that common ground. I may want to do X, you may want to do Y, but there's this Venn diagram where we overlap more than we actually differ. And I think that was where Michael and I really had to work through those things. And we spent a lot of time, you know, discussing these things. But, Michael, I don't know your perspective.
Well, okay, this from an IR perspective. What IR offices do best is analysis. Oftentimes, that's the people in those departments. That's what they are, their expertise. And really, it's the understanding that in order to get to analysis, that having business intelligence, having reporting being done not by institutional research, but by others around campus, is really a way to increase your analytic capabilities. As I like to say, we move from doing a lot of questions about what or how many to questions about why. It's not how many people graduate or what is your retention rate, but it's rather why do people graduate? How do they graduate? How can we do this better? So by integrating IR more closely into this larger function, you really increase the analytic capabilities of the office.
So another question that we've gotten from folks is about other examples of where UMBC is using analytics, or maybe you want to talk about examples outside of your own institution, but we've talked quite a bit about the use on the student side of things, but how about in finance or other areas of administration or outreach for UMBC? Other ways that you're using it?
You want to go first, I can get out of
there. Yeah, sure. So in the finance area, we are using the data warehouse solution to do a lot of our state-based financial reporting. But the vision that I have, which will be a project that we're going to start in the first half of 2013, is really thinking about how we can pull grants data in. UMBC generates quite a bit of grants-related research, and what we want to be able to do is I have this vision. Right now, Freeman every day looks at some tools that we have around admissions. I'd love for him each day to be able to be going in and seeing proposals that were submitted by department, seeing grants awarded by department, being able to be thinking about this at a higher level than what he can now. And so one of the things that I think you'll be seeing us focus on is how we can pull grants data in and provide a view so that deans, administrators, and others can really be seeing the whole picture.
Let me give an example that's not about student performance, but about how you attract customers. If we talk about students, quite frankly, the fact is that most institutions are accustomed to working with a large number of schools, for example, and the same schools all along. I had a chance some years ago to observe the problem solving at a company where I'm on the board when they realized that perhaps 70% of the revenues were associated with about 30% of the customers, and yet they were just spending as much time with customers regardless of how much money they were getting from those customers. Well, when you think about how we work with schools and places that send us students, The fact is, whatever we did 10 years ago, we probably are still doing. When I came back to my campus, I asked the question, can we identify the top high schools, for example, in-state and out-of-state, that send us students, and what percent would the top 25 send us? And it was very clear that we had not thought carefully about how we were allocating the time of our admissions counselors based on numbers of students that we would get who were prepared to come here and the yield. And it was really through the use of analytics that we were able to redistribute the resources we have, that is to have people spending more or less time at different high schools in and out of state based on the probability of getting certain numbers of students from those places. And so clearly analytics helped us to become far more effective in the use of resources in recruiting students.
So one of the other questions that a number of people have, not uncommon question, is for you to talk about the security issues that you might have had, and it goes beyond, I guess, security incidents, but who gets access to what, and how did you decide that?
Well, you know, one of the interesting things that we did around the warehouse is we have removed Social Security numbers. So Social Security number is not in the warehouse that would be there, and that was done for some really deliberate reasons. We have generally given faculty access to this kind of information. We had some tools in our old legacy where we had ways where faculty could get this information. What we're now doing is we have a process that we've worked out with the registrar where we're developing a FERPA module where they have to go through training related to FERPA and things like that for the academic side. And we feel that one of the things that as people want to get access to information, this is a driver in having them go through training, update them on what are the rules, how to be doing things appropriately, et cetera. And so that'll be one side of this. On the financial side, I would say that historically, we have been an open book. I mean, we're a state institution. Our payroll is published, you know, in the library. There are other places where you can go and get our financial records. As we looked at these things, we felt that there was more benefit by being able to provide people with access to this information. You do have issues where sometimes there will be a question about, well, should they have looked at that? But the reality is that's what gets to discussions about governance, about leadership, how we work with one another. We try to be transparent in working with faculty leaders on the budget. And so I think what we have found is that erring on the side of information access has worked in our behalf so long as we're training people about the rules.
Mm-hmm.
Michael, do you have any thoughts?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, this is a very transparent place.
By the way, you know, I have found people sometimes are surprised that we share so much with the campus and with faculty leadership. I have found that the more information people have, the more they struggle with leaders in thinking through solutions, the less judgmental they are and the more respectful they are of that process of decision making. When people don't have the information, it's very easy to think the answers or the process is quite simplistic. When it's not, it takes a lot to come to these decisions, as you know.
So the one thing, Diana, I'll just add, I know you'll ask the next question, but this one report, I wanted to really highlight what Michael's doing. As we think about the evolving nature of our reporting, one of the things we're trying to move from is from numbers to thinking more graphically. And this is a beginning start, but Michael was just a report that we had that allowed you to see grade distribution within college, within departments, within courses. And often what you'll see is grade distribution varies even among sections in a course. It may be that different faculty teach different sections of a course, and being able to quickly glance down and see what the grade distribution is really helpful in trying to do analysis about who might need help or where you have issues.
So, Freeman, let me ask you the last question that I think we'll probably have time for, and that is I know you're coming up on the 50th anniversary of the institution. What's going to happen next with analytics?
I'm looking at ways that we're using it right now to raise money and to be effective in institution advancement, quite frankly. And already it's been helpful as we've looked at trends of people who give 1 year, for example, and don't give the next year, or which groups of people, how do you define those people, those categories of people who will always give and those who will not. For a young university, as you can imagine, we want to do everything we can to build endowment. And a part of that is knowing your base of support and understanding how they give, and as Michael said, why they give. And so we're going to be doing more with those groups of alumni and others who give money. But broadly for UMBC, we've become a model of innovation, and our motto is success is never final. When people talk about, well, you've been up and coming 3 years in a row, my point is, well, you never arrive. I mean, it seems to me that the way an institution remains innovative is to continue to say it can be much better. And I would simply say we've just begun. I mean, we have more and more people who understand the need to keep asking good questions and looking in the mirror. We'll be doing more of that than ever. And our goal is to make sure the research is first rate and that we're doing everything we can to help students succeed.
You guys are really inspiring. I have to tell you that you've done so much and you've got such a positive and constructive attitude about what can be gained and how you bring people together around this. So thank you very much for sharing what you're doing at UMBC.
Thank you, Diana. Great to talk to you.
Thank you. And I want to turn now to Susan Grajcik, who is our Vice President for Data Research and Analytics at EDUCAUSE. And one of the questions that was asked early on is, what are other people doing out there in analytics? And ECAR, the EDUCAUSE Center for Applied Research, is finishing up a national study on analytics to give us an idea of what the state of analytics is in higher education. And the study isn't released yet, but Susan is here to give us a preview, and that study is going to be released August 21st. So, Susan, tell us what's going to come out.
Hi, everybody. It's great to have this opportunity to talk with you about this study. The study was conducted, as Diana said, by ECAR, and specifically the lead investigator on this study, so the person who collected all the data and created the survey instruments, wrote the report, analyzed the data, and has really been the lead on this is Jackie Bixel, a senior research analyst here at ECAR. And I'm just absolutely delighted to be able to present this work and to thank her publicly for all the work that she has done on it. Our objectives for this study were threefold. The first thing we wanted to do was look at higher ed overall and see what higher education institutions were doing with regard to analytics. Then the second thing that we wanted to do was to see where they were having difficulties, what they were perceiving as the particular challenges in making progress to analytics and barriers. And then finally, we wanted to look at the progress and where we are to date. So what do people at colleges and universities think about analytics? What are they concerned about? And where are we? Our methodology, we did two surveys. We did a survey of IT leaders by contacting EDUCAUSE members. And then we also did a survey of institutional research leaders through the Association of Institutional Research. And I'd like to thank the Association of Institutional Research publicly for all of their support with the study. And then in addition to that, Jackie led seven focus groups of IT and IR professionals from all around the country. So we got both qualitative and quantitative data. Where are we with analytics today? Well, what we found was analytics is a major priority. There's just no escaping it. If you look at all the people who are attending this sprint, that's one indication, and our data are certainly another indication. 24% of the colleges and universities who responded to the survey said that analytics was a major institutional priority. In addition to that, you look at major institutional priority and combine that with a major priority for at least some areas, you found that analytics is a major priority at over half of institutions. And then when you also add on top of that, institutions who reported, well, it's an interest, not a priority, but it's an interest, you can see that analytics is really pervasive. We found a few differences according to the types of institutions. We found that between 8 and 10% of community colleges and bachelor's institutions, that it was a little bit less of a priority in those institutions than it was in master's institutions and doctorals. So another difference that we found is that public institutions are leading right now with regard to the priority that they place on analytics. But there's some indication that private institutions are not far behind. Certainly today, there are more public institutions who place a major institutional priority on analytics. And then when you add on that it's a priority for some areas versus others, they certainly do tip the scales compared to privates. But if you look, you can see that there are more private institutions who are saying analytics is a major priority for some areas, and that more private institutions are saying it's an interest. So certainly signs that they may be catching up. Another way that we looked at the extent to which analytics is a major priority was we asked folks on the survey whether they think compared to 2 years ago, analytics is more important, just as important, or less important for higher education success. And you can see overwhelmingly people see it's more important than it was 2 years ago. Well, when we ask people to look forward 2 years, do they think it's going to continue, or is this really a flash in the pan? And you can see that looking forward 2 years from now, nobody thinks it's going to be less important. And again, over 80% think that analytics will be more important for higher education success. So analytics is here for the time being. Then one important aspect of analytics is the data that you use. What types of data are you using in analytics? Now, as we've spoken to analytics experts, one of the things that they do ask is they ask about, or they reflect on is that the type of data can give you more or less capabilities of doing more or less sophisticated things with analytics. And certainly if you think about the buzzword big data, what that really means are sort of clicks and swipes and system-generated behavioral data. These bar charts tell us the extent to which people are using data right now in their analytics activities. And you can see that overwhelmingly frozen data or transactional data, survey data are being used much more frequently than the data that would contribute to big data or clicks and swipes and other types of system-generated behavioral data. So that's something that we're gonna want to watch out for over time and see the extent to which that system-generated behavioral data becomes increasingly common. Now, who's responsible for analytics activities in institutions? And this is why we really felt that in order to study analytics in higher education, we needed both the IT and the IR perspective. Because you can see that IT and IR most often share responsibility for analytics. In 39% of the responses, people said that analytics is a shared responsibility between IT and IR. More often than not, if it was one or the others, it was IRs. And then we saw a little bit of indications of dedicated analytics centers, either standalone or that IT and IR reported into. So again, that'll be an interesting thing to track over time. Now, who leads analytics at the institution? And it's really all over the map. We didn't see any clear patterns other than perhaps there are multiple leaders of analytics at institutions. And if you think about what's happening right now with institutions, there are a few institutions who are placing an overall institutional priority on analytics. We saw it's about a quarter of them. But more often than not, there are pockets of areas in an institution who are really focusing on analytics. And so I think that's why you're not seeing so much that there's a real pattern, but that there are really multiple areas that oversee analytics at institutions. What areas are folks investing in analytics activities? What we're finding is it's really in the student areas, enrollment management, student progress, really being able to see how we can help students succeed and that we get the right students who are the right fit for the institution, and that also that we help students complete their degrees successfully. Finance and budgeting is another area. Just parenthetically, I'll pause and say that EDUCAUSE convened a panel of experts in analytics earlier this year, and we asked those experts, how do you get started in analytics? And a very common bit of advice that they gave us was follow the money, and that institutions that begin by looking at analytics in the finance areas, that that seems to be a good and fruitful area for analytics to really take hold in an institution. You can also, if you look, you can see areas where analytics is not so common. And most notably with regard to faculty performance, whether it's promotion and tenure, teaching, or research. Not a lot happening with some other common administrative areas like HR, facilities, procurement. And the most common administrative area for analytics to be working in is central IT. Another question that we asked on the survey was we asked the extent to which people could identify role models for analytics activities and initiatives at their institution. This was a free response question. We had people write in and say what the role models were. And I think this gives you a good sense for how pervasive and diverse analytics activities are in our institutions right now. People named academic areas, they named administrative areas, they named centers of capability for analytics, IT and IR, and then a whole bunch of cats and dogs in the other category or specific strategic initiatives. So you can see analytics is really peppered throughout the institution. Now, I'm going to talk to you a little bit about the areas in which, when we asked what are the opportunities for really making more progress with analytics when you balance out the challenges against where we think we can really make an impact. I'm going to talk with you about that. And then also when we said to people, where are you having difficulty? What are the challenges? What are the barriers to making progress? So when we ask people to balance out the potential benefit against the difficulty of applying analytics to various areas, we found that, again, understanding student behavior, recruiting students, student outcomes, that those were the most common perceived big wins that folks could make with analytics. Optimizing use of resources was another one, and that may make you think that, oh, great, we could use analytics, you know, pretty easily. It's a pretty easy lift to use analytics to reduce costs or contain costs. But actually, if you look a little bit further down this chart, cost was an area where people thought that perhaps the difficulty was going to be holding us back. So reducing administrative costs, containing or lowering the cost of education, those areas were a little bit less commonly seen as the best places to get benefits from analytics. You'll see improving faculty performances down there also. What are folks' biggest concerns around analytics? Affordability. How are we going to be able to afford this? This is a big investment. What are we going to be able to do? I'm going to tell you a little bit about some of the things that we found that that may shed light on how to make analytics affordable. Data was another big area. People were concerned that there were concerns around data being misused. There were concerns about regulations requiring the use of data. And, you know, around those regulations requiring the use of data, folks were concerned about the burden of reporting requirements. They were concerned that the regulations were asking them to provide data that they didn't have, or perhaps were asking asking them to report on data in ways that perhaps were not the optimal ways to actually report on data. Inaccurate data. You know, one of the best anecdotes from our expert panel that somebody mentioned, one of our experts said that it's even a challenge to get consistent definitions of how we're going to count the number of faculty and students we have at our institution. And any of you who've tried to do that at your institutions, I'm sure you're nodding your heads right now saying, yeah, it depends on how you define it. And if we think about how to define that across institutions when we can't even define it within our institution, you can see some of the challenges around that. What we didn't see was we didn't see cynicism around analytics, people saying, well, what we do in higher education can't be measured. Very few people thought that. And very few people were dismissive and saying, oh, this is just trying to run higher education like a business, and that can't be done. So I think there were some interesting findings in that respect. Well, where are we making progress in analytics? And what are the different components that you should be thinking of for making progress and measuring your progress in analytics? We asked in the survey, we gave 21 items and asked IR and IT professionals to tell us to what extent the following were in place, each of those 21 items were in place to enable the institution to make progress with analytics. We did a factor analysis of those items, and we identified five components to analytics maturity and progress. The first was culture and process, and that included items that showed that the leadership was committed, that the institution had processes for using data to make decisions that were embedded in the institution. The second factor was around data and reporting and tools, that we have the right data, that it's clean and standardized, that we've got the right reports, that we have the tools and the software that we need. The third was investment, that we have the right levels of funding and the right amount of staffing for analytics. Related to investment is expertise, that we have the people with the right skills in IT, IR, and that the business has the skills that they need to be able to apply analytics to their areas. And by business, I mean I mean everything from the registrars to finance and procurement and everybody in between who is actually going to be able to make use of this data to be able to improve the areas that they're responsible for. And the fifth component was governance and infrastructure. Do we have the capacity to store all this data? Do we have IT professionals who are supporting analytics? And do we have the right policies regarding security and rights to data? So where do we stand? Well, our biggest challenge is investment. So if you look at this chart, you'll see the brighter blue line at the top, and that says the percent of people who answered the survey who said, these components are in place at my institution. The darker blue line or purple line, depending on what your screen is showing at the bottom, those are the percentages of institutions who said this isn't in place. And where do we have the biggest disconnect? It's in investment. Many more say we don't have the investments in place than say we have them. We're doing best in infrastructure and culture. A lot more say that's in place, and we're in the middle on data and expertise. Now I want to go into a little bit more detail because the devil's always in the details on this. And where are the strengths? So more than 80% of the institutions specifically said we've got senior leaders interested in using data to make decisions. Senior leadership is in place. And we've identified the key outcomes that we're going to target. So those two fundamentals are in place in far more institutions when they are not. Where are we making progress? Well, between 55% and 70% of institutions reported that their administration accepts analytics. They've got the capacity to store and analyze data. They've got information security and policies and practices in place. They've got institutional research professionals, the right kind of data, and data policy. So we're looking quite good. Now here's where we get into gaps, and we've got quite a few gaps. Between only 30% and 50% of institutions report that they've got the right tools, that they've got IT expertise, that they've got good data. When by good data, we really mean clean data and standardized data, that we've got a culture that accepts the use of data to make decisions and good reports. So we've got some progress to make there. More progress. Analytics funding is viewed as an investment rather than an incremental expense. So less than 50% reported having that. That we have dedicated analytics professionals. So these are people with special expertise. And we've got a gap there. And in fact, more institutions say we don't have this than say we have this. That we have functional owners who know how to apply analytics. And again, where we've got bigger gaps, more institutions don't have this than have this, a process for using data to make decisions, and faculty acceptance of the use of analytics. And then our biggest gaps are in investment. Fewer than 20%, fewer than one in five institutions have the appropriate amount of funding and the appropriate number of analysts, and more than 50% say they don't have it. Investments, so how do you make progress with investments? Well, one of the things that we found was we also asked a question, and you saw that a little bit earlier, do you view analytics as an investment or an expense? And we found that institutions who view it as an investment are more likely to have the appropriate funding in place. So think about making the case for funding in analytics, and think about how you make the case as an investment in the future of your institution and the future success of your institution rather than an expense. And that's one of the ways that you can make progress in investing for analytics and in funding. So once again, leadership is the magic ingredient. We found that institutions that made analytics a priority, and we found this with our focus groups also, that if senior leaders are making analytics a priority, that those institutions are making more progress with culture, more progress with investment, more progress with expertise, and with infrastructure. And in fact, the only area where placing a priority on analytics is not associated with more progress is in data. And it's kind of not surprising because data is a pretty hard nut to crack. So, final points. Analytics is widely viewed as important, and IT and IR are both critical partners. Having both IT and IR professionals respond to the survey gave us the opportunity to be able to identify differences between IT and IR. We found that information technology professionals are more optimistic than institutional research around the potential for analytics, and that IT professionals rated their institutions as making more progress on culture and infrastructure. But institutional research thinks that we're more advanced with expertise, and that our focus group results suggested that when you've got really good communication and collaboration between institutional research and information technology, that that's when you're going to get great success with analytics. Analytics activities are occurring throughout institutions, but we're making the most progress and most activity with regard to student and financial areas, that there's least optimism that we're going to be able to use analytics to lower higher ed costs, but maybe in optimizing resources. And the big challenge, how can we afford analytics? And the hint, think about positioning it as an investment. So thank you very much. And Diana, are there any questions?
You bet. And I think we heard the same thing to your final point. We heard the same thing from Freeman and Jack and his colleagues to position analytics as an investment. So one of the points we didn't get to that came up as a question for you, Susan, as well as in the previous session, is about the talent and the skill gap that we seem to find in analytics. Where are we going to get those data scientists? Anything in the study that speaks to that?
Well, I think that perhaps not so much in the study as much as some of the feedback that we've gotten from the expert panel. That is, there are programs and also I think from some of the work that we've done with the IT issues panel. There are a couple of ways, there are a number of ways to do this. One is to consider the staff in your institution and consider the extent to which you can retrain and retool staff. We know that some of the things that we're doing as IT shops really reform and change some of the things they're doing by moving things to the cloud. I think there's an opportunity to retrain and retool existing staff. We are sitting on a gold mine of the fact that as higher education institutions, we're actually training people. We have programs in statistics, for example, that are graduating people with a lot of the skill sets. More and more, we're seeing programs that are training data scientists. And, in fact, North Carolina State is one of the pioneers in this area and offering MBAs in analytic sciences. So I think that there are some opportunities there as well. And I also think that another thing that did come out of the study and the focus groups was the extent to which we can try to become more strategic with what we have our IT and our IR professionals do in the area of data warehouse, business intelligence, and institutional research. We can actually perhaps free up their capacity to be able to do more with analytics, more with research, and less with simply churning out more and more reports.
Great. One of the questions that came up early on, Susan, is about whether you are going to do this survey every year, whether you're going to repeat it or do different kinds of surveys. Do you know what the research agenda is for next year?
We're forming the research agenda for next year right now. We don't have plans to repeat this survey every year, and gosh, I wish we had the resources to be able to repeat so many of our studies on an annual basis. But certainly I think that this will bear repeating in 2 or 3 years because I think that this is a field to watch. As we think about research agenda for next year, I think that one of the things that would be interesting to do would be to do a deep dive in a particular area where the most activity is occurring, specifically in the student areas, and to learn more about what's happening in learning analytics. And I'd love to be able to see if we could figure out how to do that. We may also do a little bit of a deeper dive into what's happening with regard to the IT workforce, and that might enable us to ask a few questions about analytics. And then finally, the core data survey that EDUCAUSE repeats every year gives us some information about the analytics infrastructure. And so we'll get some data from that, too, so that we can track the tools and solutions folks are using for their analytics infrastructure.
So, Susan, the flip side of the question that we were asking earlier about investment, and maybe it's rhetorical, but you may have something you want to add to this, is what is the cost of not investing in analytics? What's the cost of not having it?
Yeah, and that is exactly the way to position some of these arguments. So as you think about making the case for analytics, either within your area on campus or for your institution overall, you should really make that point. What is the cost of having students take 5 years to graduate instead of 4? What is the cost for faculty recruitments that don't work out? What is the cost for enrollment and not bringing in the right students? What is the cost for every time? And I think that we heard this. I think Freeman mentioned this. What's the cost of when students have to repeat a course? So really think about putting forward those costs and the extent to which making better decisions and having more and better information for analytics can help you avoid those costs and investing in analytics. That's exactly the right way to think about this.
One other quick question, because we have tended to talk a lot about the student side, and we will focus on learning tomorrow, so you all come back tomorrow for the webcast. Any examples to cite on the facilities side, for example, Susan?
On using data for facilities?
On analytics in facilities?
I don't have data to cite about that other than to say that I certainly have anecdotal evidence to suggest that institutions are keenly aware in a couple of areas of facilities. And one is the whole carbon footprint and the energy footprint in an institution and really being able to measure that and monitor that over time. And then the other area is with regard to space utilization and how do we get a handle on space utilization. And I know that institutions are keenly interested in trying to come up with metrics for how much space, do we have guidelines for how much space we should be providing for different programs, for different roles at the institution? Do we understand how much space we're devoting right now? Do we understand how much space we're devoting by mission at the institution? So those are all areas. I know that some institutions are, as they look at faculty productivity and they look at faculty productivity with regard to teaching loads, with regard to research funding, that they're trying to compare that with the amount of space being given to individual faculty and trying to come up with various costs for that and metrics. So I know that that institutions are trying to do that, and that's a big area where, as you saw, data is going to be the biggest challenge in trying to get the right data.
Thanks. That was probably not the most common question, but Jack is still online and says that they've got a space reporting cube. And Jack, if you're still there, if you want to say just a word or share a URL, that might point people to another resource.
Sure. We have started to integrate space, especially classroom, and we're starting now to go into research. But one of the things, reports that we can do, and I'll share a presentation, which was just looking at projector utilization in smart classrooms by course and things like that, where we're able to pull all of our data from projectors as well as course utilization and be able to merge the two. That's one of the interesting things of some of these cubes is being able to take data from very different sources and bring them together and look at them in different ways.
Perfect. Thank you. And we are just about out of time, even though there are tons and tons of questions. But as you know, we are not just having this discussion during the webcast this afternoon, but there are a number of different ways that we can continue the conversation. So I hope you all won't go away. But let me point you to some of the resources that are in the chat space. Some case studies. The last issue of EDUCAUSE Review is on analytics, so lots of information out there for you all. But I do want to thank Susan and Freeman, Jack, and Michael for all that they've shared with us today. I think there's a wealth of information here that I hope you all will be able to go back to later. And before you sign off, if you would just take a moment and click on the session evaluation link, you'll find it at the bottom of your screen. Your comments are very important to us, so please do take a moment to fill out the evaluation. And as you know, if you missed any part of today's conversation, you want to share it with others, you want to replay it again, it will be archived on the EDUCAUSE site later on today, including a complete replay of the session. And I hope you'll join us right now on IdeaScale, which is our conversation hub for the sprint, to keep the conversation going. So you can access idea scale from that link on the Sprint website as well as what you see on the screen. So this is Diana Oblinger. Thank you for joining us today. And as you know, we have two more days coming on discussion on analytics. Thanks, everyone, for being here. Bye-bye.